Welcome to the Athenaeum Review podcast, and we're so happy this afternoon to be speaking with Cynthia Haven, who's a National Endowment for the Humanities public scholar and the author most recently of Czesław Miłosz, A California Life, which is out now from Heyday Books. Cynthia, thanks very much for having this conversation.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, I thought that maybe I could just start by asking you to kind of tell us a little bit about where this book came from and how you got started writing it. I know that you're the author of two previous books on Miłosz, and I wonder maybe how those eventually led to this.
Well, the publisher of Heyday, my publisher for this book, was somebody I'd worked for when he was the editor of the Los Angeles Times Book Review, and I was interested that he was starting this new venture. And he told me he wanted to do a series on California lives. And I said, that sounded great. And he said, I'd like you to think of an idea. And I said, okay, how about Czesław Miłosz? Mm-hmm. And he kind of jerked a bit. And he said, isn't he Polish?
Right.
And I said, well, we're all from somewhere else here. I mean, that's the nature of America, and particularly California.
Yeah.
And, well, didn't he dislike us? And I said, what could be more American than protest? I mean, he liked us, he didn't like us, he became an American, he resisted being an American, he was a man of contradictions.
Yeah.
And yet, he couldn't have done what he did without America. And yeah. I think he knew that. It made him an international poet rather than a local one. It's the reason for the Nobel.
Yeah.
And it changed his perspective. And I think it changed us too. And I would like to see his influence deepen and broaden, because I think he's a poet for all of us. And I think we have a great deal to learn from him. And most of all, to enjoy him, because I go to his poetry for joy, for the pleasure of it, not out of a sense of, as you know, he's been called a poet of witness. He's credited with coining that phrase.
Yeah.
And it's a phrase that kind of makes people drop to one knee.
Yeah.
And feel like something is a duty. But he was also a poet of ecstasy. He was a poet of joy. Mm-hmm. And I think he's one of the best poetic pioneers for old age since Walt Whitman. He described, because he lived to 94. I just have a few lines here. This is from his separate notebooks. The bright side of the planet moves towards darkness, and the cities are falling asleep, each in its hour. And for me, now as then, it is too much. There is too much world. Mm. I just found those at random yesterday, and wow.
Wow, yeah.
It's describing the earth turning and the night coming on city after city as it turns.
Wow.
Yes, I know. It's he's a marvelous, marvelous poet.
You know, you mentioned Whitman, and there was this this idea in the book that I wanted to ask you about, there is the, I guess, what's known as the Vatic tradition, and I actually wasn't familiar, but VATIC, for anyone who doesn't know that word, which I think, correct me if I'm wrong, is a little bit like kind of bardic or prophetic kind of tradition. But anyway, I wondered if you could kind of explain what is the Vatic tradition, and what's Miłosz's kind of relationship to that?
Well, yes, it has a general meaning, but it had a very particular meaning in Poland.
Okay.
Going back to the 16th century. I mean, this is a country on the plains that has been continually occupied, taken over, beaten up.
Yeah.
Had 125 years of partition until it was made an independent nation only in the last century on its own.
Yeah.
And language in Poland, in the Polish commune, took the place of a political power.
Right.
And it began with Mickiewicz, really, and kind of a contemporary of Pushkin and Byron. There was an idea of Poland, as I think it began with Mickiewicz, is a Christ among nations. And so it got mixed up with a lot of political messianism. And they still turn to it. And it's the basis of Polish poetry. And it's kind of a hard shadow for them to duck.
Like poets would be a kind of either speaking to or on behalf of the people as a whole, and the poets would be kind of expected to take that role of articulating that sense of Polish.
Well, that's a big weight to put on on poetry's shoulders.
Right.
Go ahead, please.
Oh, sorry. Would you say that coming to another country, i.e. this country, was in any way helped him get out from feeling that pressure? That's kind of an interesting sense that, well, he moves across an ocean to a whole totally different place, but it's not like he necessarily can leave behind that sense of pressure completely.
Well, there's a lot of history that happened.
Yeah.
He was in Warsaw for the destruction of Warsaw.
Yeah.
He saw a whole bunch of young men, his colleagues, fellow poets who had signed on to these notions and were slaughtered.
Yeah.
In a sense, because of their idealism. Here's a poem he wrote in 1945 Warsaw with this subject in mind. He wrote, "You whom I could not save, listen to me. Try to understand this simple speech as I would be ashamed of another. I swear there is in me no wizardry of words. I speak to you with silence like a cloud or tree. What strengthened me for you was lethal. You mixed up farewell to an epic with the beginning of a new one. Inspiration of hatred with lyrical beauty, blind force with accomplished shape. Here is the valley of shallow Polish rivers and an immense bridge going into white fog. Here is a broken city, and the wind throws the screams of gulls on your grave when I am talking with you. What is poetry which does not save nations or people? A connivance with official lies, a song of drunkards whose throats will be cut in a moment, readings for sophomore girls. That I wanted good poetry without knowing it, that I discovered late its salutary aim. In this, and that only this, I find salvation. They used to pour millet on graves or poppy seeds to feed the dead who would come disguised as birds. I put this book here for you, who once lived, so that you should visit us no more." That's a poem for one of these, for this generation of men who perished.
And when, what year was that written, did you say?
1945.
Wow. So coming, this question of kind of coming all the way over here and then trying to communicate with these, with American teenagers who, yeah. who I mean, that was a huge, I mean, obviously he was up to it, but it must have been such a daunting thing to try and get some of that into their minds.
Yes, this was a problem for him, as he would say sometimes, you know, they rage because they have too much.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was speaking across an abyss.
Yeah.
Of experience, and there's that well-known story, I like it, where he was blocked on going to campus by a bunch of protesting students. And I always imagine him shaking his cane.
Yeah.
"Begone, spoiled children of the bourgeoisie." Yeah. And they parted and made way for him.
It was really interesting. I mean, as maybe from an American perspective, kind of thinking about the 60s and all of the kind of protests, there's a lot of people might say, well, it's kind of this conflict between the bourgeoisie and the counterculture. But it sounds like for Miłosz coming from a very different place, that he almost, I mean, would you say that he almost saw the protesting youth as like a kind of just another side of that bourgeois world? I mean, as you said, he said you're the children of the bourgeoisie, but they maybe still had more in common with the straight world than they did with what he knew in Poland. I don't know.
It was a completely different world, wasn't it? Yeah. I have an incident in the book where he confronts the students about the Indochina War.
Yeah.
And the easiness, I mean, basically the easiness of putting on a white armband.
Yeah.
Compared to what he had been through, where you could be taken out in the middle of the night and shot.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was no way of reaching across that abyss.
Yeah.
And yet, that's kind of an enormous number of students were transformed by his teaching. Yeah. He came to a nation where, as he described it, Polish was an unheard of tongue.
Yeah.
And he fixed the problem by teaching his students to be translators, a huge number of translators. A significant number of his translators came out of his classrooms.
Yeah, yeah.
And if they didn't actually translate, they developed an appreciation for what he was doing. In his first few years here, he wrote a big fat book. I think it's about 600 pages.
Yeah.
History of Polish Literature.
Yeah.
And it didn't sell well at first. It sells now. It's still post-war Polish poetry. He was the first person with Peter Dale Scott to translate Zbigniew Herbert. Mm-hmm. And his post-war Polish poetry, which is still a magnificent book. He introduced people like Adam Zagajewski, East Polish Zimborska.
Yeah.
Zbigniew Herbert, Rozejewicz were introduced to an American public, to an English-speaking public. That was an enormous achievement in his first few years here.
Yeah, yeah.
The reason there was this miracle of Polish poetry in the 20th century and two Nobel poets in the last, is his efforts.
Yeah.
Quietly, not knowing he was going to make a difference, fearing at many points that his life was lost or wasted, that he was kind of going to disappear into nothingness.
Wow.
With his poetry, with his Poles not being able to read his poetry, he had no idea that people were reading it.
Yeah. And then there was that amazing moment in the book where I guess it's after he won the Nobel Prize, and whatever that moment was, when the first time that he stepped back onto the ground there, going back to Poland for the first time in however many years, and it sounds like he was just like a rock star, that there was so much public appreciation for him. It was really remarkable.
Well, I like what Helen Wendler, the critic, said. He knew, but he didn't know because he hadn't seen.
Yeah, yeah.
He was, Zbigniew Herbert came to the U.S. People would come to the U.S. But to suddenly see it, to have your book go into print for the first time since the war.
Yeah.
To sell out 100,000 copies in the first few days. It was an enormous vindication.
Yeah. Did, I know you, I know you mentioned Whitman a moment ago, and I know there was something in the book about Faulkner, and he had esteem for Faulkner, but I'm curious whether, would you say that American literature was teaching in the context of America and trying to come to grips with living here, would you say that American literature was something that he valued in terms of trying to make sense of this strange place called California or America, or particular American authors?
Well, his indefatigable quality. I mean, he was just, I mean, he did, and we should go back after the fall of Warsaw. He didn't he describes the process in one of his two novels, Seizure of Power, was published in 1955. There was, the country was destroyed. There was nothing to do. The best opportunity was to go abroad, to get an appointment, a diplomatic appointment.
Yeah.
He was intelligent. He was already a well-known poet, and he got an appointment as a cultural attaché. Mm-hmm. Some people have criticized him even recently for that, for collaborating with the Stalinist government. Mm-hmm. But as his son says, that's to say he had a job. There were no other jobs. The government had the jobs. It was a low-ranking appointment.
Right.
He went to New York City and he quickly acquainted himself with every major poet that he could. And he wrote a columns for that that were sent back to Poland and published in Poland about American writers. Mm. He became good friends with Thornton Wilder. He met T.S. Eliot on his way over to England. It was a, he even wrote about Negro spirituals. Mm. he immersed himself in American culture. Mm-hmm. And American literature. He even went to the Breadloaf Conference. Mm-hmm. So he had a very early immersion into American literature, and he loved it.
You know, speaking of the, you know, working for the government and so forth. So, and seeing, and some people, I guess, especially among the exiles or people who saw that as compromising him in that direction. But he, you know, he was so well known for writing The Captive Mind, and did that mean that would he be kind of suspected by both the left and right of being either, you know, too politically compromised in the other direction, because he seemed to be possibly questionable both from a left wing and a right wing perspective?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. And I described that process in my book. I was able to get some of the American surveillance.
Right.
And the surveillance on the American side didn't stop really till he came to Berkeley in 1960.
Oh, I'm surprised it stopped.
At least the records stop. I don't know what might have gone. My trail ends at that point.
Yeah.
I think he eventually just became a Berkeley professor and people kind of left him alone. But he was, the emigre community in America was very much against his coming to America after his defection in 1951.
Yeah.
You probably tell that story. He was a Polish diplomat. He was in New York. Then he got transferred to Washington, D.C., a boring factory town for government, as you know, where he was less in touch with the cultural currents of the U.S. than he had been in New York. Mm-hmm. But he served there. He continued to write poems there. And then he was recalled to Poland. And his passport was taken away. Mm-hmm. And he had to do some fancy dancing and get some help.
Yeah.
To get his passport back, which was enough for him. I apologize. I left out. He was had been appointed to Paris.
Right.
He was called back to Poland. He went back to Paris and immediately prepared for his defection. And it was the first the most high-ranking defection from the Stalinist government to that point. It was a very public defection.
Yeah.
He gave his reasons in the press, I guess that more than the rank, he was not a high-ranking person, but he gave his press conference describing his reasons for defection. And he later compared the process of Stalinism to swallowing frogs. Wow. He said you might be able to manage, you know, one frog or two frog, but after that point it is no longer the reaction of the mind.
Yeah.
It is the revolt of the stomach.
Yeah.
And could no longer even by twisting and turning support what was happening in Poland.
You know, one of the kind of ideas that was really fascinating. I mean, thinking of his kind of grappling with these political questions, but it kind of goes throughout the book, is that I learned that he always had this interest in kind of the question of being and becoming, like one of these basic philosophical questions. There's kind of the timeless world of being, and then the always changing kind of experience of becoming. And it sounds like this is something that kind of goes throughout lots of his thinking and his work. And I wondered if you could just maybe explain a little bit about what that means to him. I know it's a really big thing.
It's a question I've spent 20 years now exploring. Okay. I first interviewed him in the year 2000, and I brought up this topic at that time, Treatise on Poetry, which deals with it, I think, more directly probably than anywhere else. Etre and Devenir, as he put it in the French, but it's got its roots in Thomas Aquinas, and that's a very deep river indeed. He kind of equated Essa, or nature, being is the essential role of the poet, the specificity of thisness. Versus the engine of history, the Devenir, the constant change. And striking a balance between them, or well, he said, I'm looking for something that he said. He basically, he said the counterpoised realms of Etre de Nivir forced a choice between being and acting. Or for the poet, between art on one hand and solidarity with one's fellow men, which is moving into the world of devenir, of becoming, of change. Well, nobody wants to be an orphan, really, and to side with Essa or Etre. He said that the only possible, all art, he said, has proves to be nothing compared with action. And so the only possible compromise is distance. And he's often quoting Simone Weil's, distance is a soul of beauty. And as he said in his Nobel speech, to embrace reality in such a manner that it is preserved in all its tangle of good and evil, of despair and hope, is only possible thanks to distance, only by soaring above it. But this in turn seems to be a moral treason. You're abandoning the world of action. You're abandoning this solidarity with your fellow men. But the work of the poet was to be in Essa, in being, a sort of contemplative role. And it's interesting, he often talks about nature. He was his first real, he considered his first calling to be as a naturalist. And that was one of his difficulties coming to America. He had read James Fenimore Cooper as a boy in Lithuania. He was Lithuanian born, although in the Polish speaking gentry.
He was coming to a different natural environment here.
A different natural environment, but a wrong picture of America. He saw America as nature.
Right.
And well, that didn't prepare him for the television sets, the consumerist, you know, Elvis Presley, for all the things he was going to see in America. And the forces of history, there's no way of avoiding those either.
Yeah. So speaking of nature, well, with California in particular, something that really struck me, we hear people say all the time about California in particular, that Californian nature, the beaches are so nice and the mountains are, you know, it's like a kind of pleasant atmosphere, you know, the climate is so, so enjoyable and all these sorts of things. But I mean, I think actually right in the very first chapter, right at the beginning of the book, you start to show us, and then it continues, how in certain ways you could describe the natural environment in California as in certain ways inhuman or kind of.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and so I wonder if you could tell us how a little about that and how he responded to being physically in such a place.
Well, there's nothing like the California redwoods in Poland. Poland is a nature on a much smaller scale. The vastness of our deserts, the dryness of everything is on a superhuman scale. Los Angeles is on a superhuman scale. Compared the redwood trees to the cathedrals of Europe, only they're much there's no column in the cathedrals of Europe that matches the size and scale of a redwood.
Yeah. There was, we were talking a minute ago that the poem Magic Mountain that I wondered if you might be able to read that one in terms of the connection with California and so forth.
It's very much connected with California, and I love this poem.
Yeah,
it's one of my favorites. But I like it for its spiritual qualities, really, because it shows a turning point. He had been a well-known poet in Poland, one of its leading young poets. Now he was no longer able to be read, and nobody knows really what he does. He's teaching Dostoevsky at UC Berkeley.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's completely unknown at this point. He wrote this poem in what, 1975? Mm-hmm. So his poems were just beginning to be published in English. And he wrote A Magic Mountain. It begins, I don't remember exactly when Budberg died. It was either 2 years ago or three. The same with Chen, whether last year or the one before. Soon after our arrival, Budberg, gently pensive, said that in the beginning it is hard to get accustomed, for here there is no spring or summer, no winter or fall. I kept dreaming of snow and birch forests, where so little changes you hardly notice how time goes by. This is, you will see, a magic mountain. Budberg, a familiar name in my childhood. They were prominent in our region, this Russian family, descendant of the German Balts. I read none of his works, too specialized. And Chen, I have heard, was an exquisite poet, which I must take on faith, for he wrote in Chinese. Sultry Octobers, cool Julys. Trees blossom in February. Here the nuptial flight of hummingbirds does not forecast spring. Only the faithful maple sheds its leaves every year. For no reason, its ancestors simply learned it that way. I sensed Budberg was right, and I rebelled. So I won't have power, won't save the world. Fame will pass me by, no tiara, no crown. Did I then train myself, the unique, to compose stanzas for gulls and sea haze, to listen to the foghorns blaring down below? Until it passed. What passed? Life. Now I am not ashamed of my defeat. One murky island with its barking seals or parched desert is enough to make us say, yes, we. See, even asleep, we partake in the becoming of the world. Endurance comes only from enduring. With a flick of the wrist, I fashioned an invisible rope and climbed it, and it held me. What a procession! Quelle délice! What caps and hooded gowns! Most respected Professor Budberg, most distinguished Professor Chen, wrong, honorable Professor Miłosz, who wrote poems in some unheard of tongue. Who will count them anyway? And here's sunlight, so that the flames of their tall candles fade. And how many generations of hummingbirds keep them company as they walk on across the magic mountain? And the fog from the ocean is cool, for once again, it is July. It's a beauty, but it's the crash and burn of his expectations of being a famous poet, and his embracing of his humility, and the attitude of being in California, where the ocean is cool in July.
you mentioned, I think, before reading the kind of spiritual aspect. Or the way that he I guess maybe his concern with matters of spirituality in general, and in particular in relation to his own history and identity and all that sort of thing. I wonder if you could comment on kind of how he approached such questions.
Well, he thought the biggest crisis of our time was the loss of what he called second space. Mm-hmm. The inability to, the shriveling of a spiritual imagination that can imagine a heaven or hell, immortality, all of that. It's everything shrunk into a little here and a little now. That was the subject, the title of his last volume, Second Space. It was a title poem.
Yeah.
And also, as you know, in the book, I talk a lot about the mountains of Parnassus, where the various characters are dealing with the loss of second space, of the proposed immortality or near immortality.
Right.
And nowhere to go with it.
Yeah. It seems like, I know this is kind of well known and well understood, but being in a place like California where there's prosperity and the weather's perfect, and I mean that kind of where material things are so available that in a way is certainly deadly for trying to remember or think about things that are beyond that. I don't remember the exact quote, but I know that he remarked on how like everyone's got their TV and their lots of, you know, delicious food and just kind of the sheer prosperity and comfort of it all is a little bit treacherous, maybe. I don't know.
And his response was to retreat into Essa, into being, and up on that mountain in Grizzly Peak to translate the Psalms into Polish.
Yeah.
He taught himself Hebrew to do that.
Wow. Along with however many other languages he had, I guess. Yeah.
Well, you know, there's a funny story. And although he was born in Lithuania, and his mother was half Lithuanian, I think she was a quarter. He was a quarter Lithuanian. I think his mother was half Lithuanian. I can't remember exactly. But he never learned Lithuanian, although he was born there. His family was Polish speaking. And he began trying to teach himself Lithuanian in his 80s. And his friend and his translator, Bob Haas, said, "Why are you bothering?" And he said, "I think it may be the language of heaven."
Wow.
So he never gave up. He never let go of the rock.
Yeah, yeah.
He was continuing to write even until his last days in the hospital, and after he had gone back to Poland forever in 2000.
Well, I wonder if you'd be willing. There was I know there was this one other poem to Mrs. Professor that was, it sounded like a lot. It might be a good way to kind of finish by doing that one and having a little kind of enjoying that side of his work.
He was a playful thinker. And this is another reason why, you know, this heavy weight of this poet of witness thing falls like such a weight is because of misses the playfulness of his thought.
Yeah.
And this is a favorite one for me because I love cats and because I also object to the cruelty of cats.
Yeah.
as who does not?
Yeah.
To Mrs. Professor, in defense of my cat's honor, and not only. My valiant helper, a small-sized tiger, sleeps sweetly on my desk by the computer, unaware that you insult his tribe. Cats play with a mouse or with a half-dead mole. You are wrong, though. It's not out of cruelty. They simply like a thing that moves. For, after all, we know that only consciousness can for a moment move into the other, empathize with the pain and panic of a mouse. and such as cats are, all of nature is, indifferent, alas, to the good and the evil. Quite a problem for us, I'm afraid. Natural history has its museums, but why should our children learn about monsters, an earth of snakes and reptiles for millions of years? Nature devouring, nature devoured, butchery day and night smoking with blood. And who created it? Was it the good Lord? Yes, undoubtedly, they are innocent. Spiders, mantises, sharks, pythons. We are the only ones who say cruelty. Our consciousness and our conscience alone in the pale anthill of galaxies put their hope in a humane God who cannot but feel and think, who is kindred to us by his warmth and movement, for we are, as he told us, similar to him. Yet if so, then he takes pity on every mauled mouse, every wounded bird. Then the universe for him is like a crucifixion. Such is the outcome of your attack on the cat, a theological Augustinian grimace, which makes difficult our walking on this earth. This poem is kind of infused with the spirit of Augustine, I asked a friend who's a classical scholar about the Augustinian grimace, and he told me the whole treatment of the poem is Augustine, this wrestling with a commonplace problem that expands into a sort of universal application.
It's just amazing to listen to or treat how it goes from this sort of very
somersaulting of scale.
Well, thank you so much. We've been talking this afternoon with Cynthia Haven, who's the author of the new book, Czesław Miłosz, A California Life, which is out now from Heyday Books. Thank you very much for speaking with us, Cynthia.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And this is the Athenaeum Review podcast, and you can find out more about that at athenaeumreview.org.